I talked about going fishing and hunting with Dad, and we had great experiences doing that. Also, some great memories of the time spent with Mother. She was always available, it seemed like, and if you ever needed to talk or if you ever had problems, why, she was always there, and she was very intelligent and knew how to listen and knew how to advise. I can remember one thing that she said one time when I'm talking of mostly trying to put my memory into the area when we lived in Boise, to make my thoughts and memories of what happened in that time of my life all kind of tie together. And Mother was a great seamstress, and sewed on, of course, the old-fashioned type of sewing machine where you had a treadle underneath that you had to rock with your foot in order to make the flywheel go to let the needle, you know, go up and down and sew into the material. But she would spend hours at that sewing machine, sewing clothes for us kids, I'm sure, and for neighbors and friends. She was great about doing things like that. And one lesson that she taught me that was significant all through my life, instead of saying keep the Sabbath day holy, which she did, and we understood that, and when we read the scriptures and understood that as a commandment, but her way of making a point of keeping it the Sabbath day was, she said that every stitch you put in on Sunday, you will have to take out with your nose on Monday. And I always remember that because it was a very simple, homely way of telling you that if you did things on the Sabbath that you were not supposed to do, somehow, later on, that would come back to you. You'd have to pay for it, or that would be, you would learn your lesson the hard way from it. Another story that she told, this and didn't have any particular significance as far as teaching me anything that I remember, but I remember the story because it was funny, and I have always enjoyed humor. I think I inherited a great deal of that from my father. One of the stories that Mother told, however, was of couples that they were acquainted with. Uncle Joe and Aunt Luella. Luella was my dad's sister, married Joe Jardine, and so they were a couple of about the same age. And the Clemens that lived there in Louisville, they were good friends. Anyway, there was about four or five of these couples that would do things together. And one time there was a psychic came to and held a performance. I assume it was probably in Idaho Falls, where the theater probably was. And so they all went to this because this guy would hold like a seance type of a program or performance and claim that he could contact the spirits and answer questions for people if they had they wanted to cross the lines into the supernatural and talk to the spirits. And one of the things that the performer had told the people in the audience was that they needed to be very quiet, and that it was dark in theater, and that if anyone received any kind of a manifestation from a spirit or from any source that they weren't sure of, why they were to call out and let him know that they had this contact. Well, one of the girls in the group had to go to the bathroom, so she went out the end of the roll and went to the bathroom. When she came back, she came down the other aisle and was trying to, it was quite dark, and she was trying to find her way to the right group to go back into this, be seated with her with the friends, with mother and dad and the others that were there. And as she got to the end of the row, Uncle Joe happened to be sitting on the very end of the row, and he was a pretty big, blustery type of a guy, and was a joker and a kidder. And as she touched him on the shoulder, why, he jumped up and hollered in this loud, booming voice, "Thank you, kind spirit, for touching me." You know, and it broke up the show, and the guy that was holding it kind of got mad because the others all laughed so hard, and they made a big joke out of this Uncle Joe receiving the touch of the kind spirit when this girl touched him on the shoulder. I can remember Mother also telling about her grandfather, that'd be William, I guess, William Walker, that he was a very hard-working man, and they worked, they had ranches, and he also had a clothing store, and he had a number of businesses, but one, about once every 2 or 3 weeks, why, he would load up the buggy or the buckboard with some sacks of wheat to take into the mill, have them ground into flour, so that grandma would have flour to cook meals with. And so he would get all dressed up in his swallowtail coat and his high silk hat, and to go to the mill. And when he would get in there, he would get visiting with all of his friends, and he was well known and well liked, and it was a small community, so they would all these men would go to the mill, they would associate, and they would visit and talk, and he came home the one night from being there all day and late evening, and he drove in, and grandma was waiting, and she went and she says, "Where's my flour?" And he says, "Good heavens, woman, you can't expect a man to remember everything when he goes to the mill for flour." And he had been visiting and talking so much that he forgot to leave the wheat off to have it ground into flour. And so Mother tells us that story about Grandpa when we were young, and I remember that. I mentioned a few minutes ago about getting my sense of humor from Dad, because he always loved to tell a joke or a story. And when I was about probably 10 or 11 years old, I went to a party, a group of our age held some sort of a party. Probably somebody's birthday party or something. I don't remember exactly what, but Dad had told me a joke, and I told that joke at the party, and afterward he got such a kick out of the fact that I had repeated his joke. It was based on the idea that the English people are very slow on catching on in humor. That was always joked about, that the English were very very slow about that. So this man from England came over and was visiting some friends out there, and they decided to go hunting one day. So they got in a wagon and started down the road to go hunting, and they came to a field where there was looked like a pretty good field, but here was a sign had been put up on the fence, and it said, "Absolutely no hunting in this field." And then in smaller letters down underneath it said, "If you can't read this sign, ask the farmer across the way." Well, the two men that were from America that were taking this Englishman out, they cracked up over that sign and they laughed about it. And the Englishman looked at them kind of strange, what are they laughing at? And so they rode on down the road a ways looking for another field, and all of a sudden the Englishman started laughing, and they said, "What are you laughing at?" And he said, "Oh, I just got the joke of that sign back there." And they said, "Oh, well, fine, great." And he says, "Yeah, what if the farmer wasn't home?" So that was the joke Dad had told me, and I repeated it at the party. So that's about the first joke I ever remember telling to a group or to other people. At the time when we lived in Boise, the age spread of my older sisters made it a little difficult to be real closely associated with them. As I talked about earlier, I had experience with them teaching primary and teaching me to dance and different ways that we were associated, but most of the time it was like they were babysitters for Carlisle and I because of us being younger. But Leola, to give a kind of a description of her, she's 8 years older than I am. She was born November 24th in 1911, and I think one time earlier when I was talking, I also was talking about, I didn't give the exact date of when Dad got home off his mission and when the folks got married, but Dad got home on his mission in 1910, and the folks were married, they were married January 18th, 1911, and Leola was born the 24th of November of 1911. And so being 8 years older, that's quite a spread, especially in those younger years. As we got older and got to be adults, that age difference didn't really matter a lot then, because we could talk on the same level and we had many things in common. But I remember Leola as being very beautiful and very vivacious type of a young lady, and always seemed like always on a high. If she had a date to go out with a boy somewhere, why, it was the biggest thing that had ever happened in the world, and she would fuss over getting ready and fuss over getting her hair done, and it was just a big issue. Everything she did, she was very dramatic about everything, and this carried on later in her life. She studied and graduated from school in drama, but she was that way by nature. She just was just very pleasant and happy and bubbly and exciting to listen to when she would tell about the things that would happen. And she worked in the courthouse there in Boise, and I think she worked for Ezra Taft Benson for part of the time when she was there at the courthouse. And I don't know what other kinds of jobs she had. I know she was always working, and I guess I didn't pay any attention to what she was doing. Maud also worked in the courthouse as a secretary, and I'm pretty sure she worked for President Benson. He wasn't the president then. In fact, at the time I remember him, it was when I was put in, when I went into scouting at the age of 12. He was the president, the superintendent of the Stake MIA, Mutual Improvement Association, and Mother was the president of the Stake MIA, and so they served together running the youth organization. And Maud, I know, had worked there in the courthouse as a secretary, and I think worked in his office, and she was born June the 1st, excuse me, 1914. So there was two and a half years between Maud and Leola. And Maud was a very a little quieter, very determined person. She was very intelligent. She studied music and was more dedicated and tried harder studying her music probably than most of the rest of us did, but she had to learn everything by note because she did not have an ear. She couldn't improvise. And both my brother and I later in years, in our years when we would play together, we were always amazed. She could play anything as long as it was on paper or written down. She'd play it on the piano and do a beautiful job. But if you'd say to her, well, play a C chord or play something that, you know, play something in the key of C and just improvise, she just didn't have that ear to do that. And we were always kind of amazed at that. And Maud organized everything. Maud was always, if there was something going on, like presenting in primary like we did, if she was presenting a play or a road show or something, she was in charge. She would organize it, and she would teach the people to sing, and she'd play for it, and she would teach them to dance. And she was just a great organizer and very efficient in all those different ways. Mary was born May the 30th in 1916, so there was 2 years almost exactly between Mary and Maud. I was born May the 15th, 1920. Carlisle was born March the 1st, 1922. So there was about 4 years difference between Mary and I, 21 months between Carlisle and I. Mary and I, as we were growing up in that same time zone, a 4 year difference between a 10 or 11 year old and a 14 or 15 year old, there isn't really a lot of compatibility. I did become real good friends with Mary as we grew a little older, when she was beginning to date and learning to dance. We would dance together often, and Mary liked to go to movies, and so did I, and we went to a lot of movies together. When I was working for the theater there in Boise, I was working for the man who did all the artwork for the movies, and so I got movie tickets and could get them for the family, and I could go into any of them anytime I wanted. And so I saw a lot of movies, and Mary liked movies. We'd go together, and later she was able to reciprocate because she worked at the Paramount Theater after we had moved to Ogden. She was worked at that theater, and so she would get tickets for us to go to movies later on. When I was about 15 years old, Mary was the queen of the Golden Green Ball. That was the big final occasion each spring of the mutual year, and they would hold this Golden Green Ball, big dance, and had a queen for it, and they usually had a orchestra, and it was really quite a nice affair. And we danced an exhibition dance when I was 15. I guess she would have been 19. I don't know why she didn't dance with one of her dates, because she was always dating good-looking guys, as I remember. But anyway, we did dance together and put on this exhibition dance, and it was qualified us to go and dance at Salt Air outside of Salt Lake at the big festival that they held there in connection with General Conference. And so we went, we came down from Boise and danced out at Salt Air we didn't just dance solo. All the exhibition dancers, that we all had learned the same dance throughout the whole church, and any who could come there. So there was like 1,500 couples or something all dancing the same time in this dance festival out at Salt Air. Leola's dates always were, as I pointed out a few minutes ago, just they were real highlights, and you know, and she made big fuss over them. And Maud dated, as I recall, a lot. In fact, I think when she was there in high school, she dated the star football player, and so she was very, you know, she was popular and had dates, but you didn't hear much about them. You didn't. It wasn't broadcast or advertised or anything like Leola did hers. And Mary was a little more like that too. Mary was a little quieter about her life and a little more placid in her demeanor. And when she loved music, and she learned to play the piano also. All three of the girls took some piano lessons. And then instead of me going to the piano, though, I started me on the violin, and I studied violin. And it was the first part of the violin teaching was a group, a class of about 15 or 20 of us all trying to learn the violin at the same time, you know, under a class teacher. And I enjoyed it, and I learned quite a bit about playing the violin from that class. And I guess I got to where I sounded good enough that the folks decided that they could give me private lessons, which was a tough decision because they didn't have that much money, and had to pay private lesson was more expensive than the class. And anyway, I started taking lessons from a man called, his name was Golden Johnson, and he was real good. He was really a good violinist and an interesting teacher. And about I'd been taken from him just for a few weeks, and one of the times when I came in for my lesson, why, he said, well, play the number that you were supposed to practice on this week, and had me play that for him. So I played it through, and I got about almost through it, and he stopped me, and he said, that note you just played there, that's supposed to be an E flat, not an E natural. So he said, go through that again. So I started over and played it again, and I got about the same place, and he says, that's supposed to be an E flat, not an E natural. And he says, so change that. And so he did that about three times. And after the third time, why, he said, here's the piece of music that you've been practicing. And, you know, and I had the sheet of music on the stand in front of me. And he says, start right here and start playing it right here. And I looked at him and I said, well, play that for me and then I can do that. And he said, no, you start right there. And I looked at him and I said, I don't know how to start right there. And he says, and so then he began to work with me and figured out that I didn't know how to read music. In that class, every time the teacher would play something, I could play it. I could duplicate what they would play. And so that was how I was learning to play the violin. And when Mr. Johnson found out then that I literally did not know how to read music at all. I hadn't read any, and the way I would get by would be I would talk him into playing, show me how it was supposed to sound, the one I was supposed to practice on for all week. Well, I practiced it all week, but I practiced it with a wrong note because I couldn't read the music to know that it was a wrong note. So he started me right from scratch then, and then I had to learn about the staffs and the spaces and the notes and what they were and the scale and the chromatic scale and all the different stuff about music in order to really understand and know what I was basically playing on the violin, and could then pick up that piece of music and read it without having to have somebody else play it for me first. Carl had an excellent ear also for music, and I don't remember whether they had him take any piano lessons or not, but when he started with an instrument, he started to learn to play the bass. He learned the string bass, and he also learned to play the tuba and the sousaphone, and he would play those in the bands and the orchestras as we were through school. And then later years, he also then played the bass guitar and then enjoyed that, so he taught himself to play the regular guitar as well. And he loves to play, and he especially loves to sing and remembers words. He must have 250 to 300 songs that he knows all the words to. I always thought that was really quite remarkable how he had that talent for that. And he has an ear like I do where we can improvise, we can play. If we hear something, we can pretty well play it after we've once listened to it. And both of us ended up with that talent that we enjoy playing together when we get together. I went from the violin. When I went to go in the service, violin wasn't particularly a comfortable instrument to haul around traveling around in the Air Force, so I bought a guitar and a little book of how to play the guitar and 10 easy lessons for 50 cents. And I learned enough basic chording on the guitar that I could enjoy that. And so then later on I started to play mandolin and would play just mandolin just for the fun of it when he would play the guitar, and then we'd sing together. We've had a lot of fun together over the years. We renewed that acquaintance after our kids were grown and we spent some time, but I'm jumping way ahead. So I wanted to kind of stay in memories of the time in Boise. And Carlisle and I were pretty good friends as we were growing up. We're 2 years apart, but we were very near the same size most of the time. He was very interested in sports of all kinds, and just really that was the big highlight and the important thing in his life. And because of the music that I was doing, Mother didn't want me to get too involved in sports. She thought I might hurt my hands and make it hard for me to play the violin, but I think I used that as an excuse. I don't know that I was really ever that interested in sports. I used to love to run, and I was a good runner. I played a little tennis when I was about a freshman in high school. I understood and knew some of the basics of some of the sports, but I really never did become proficient in any of them or even really become that involved in them. I guess I was just too lazy, I don't know, but I love to hike. I love to go out and hike through the mountains, and I could hike all day and with a full pack and seem to get along fine, you know. So it wasn't that I was necessarily real weak, it was just that I didn't involve myself that much in sports. I guess there's always a challenge between kids, especially as they're smaller. And Carlisle being the baby, there were quite a few times when I felt that our parents would treat him as the baby. And if anything happened, why did you do that to him, you know, rather than there ever much of a consideration. But it wasn't severe, it wasn't extreme, but I do remember one time when I was about probably 8 or 9 years old, and that would put him 6 or 7, and he was a pretty good tease, or at least that particular day he had decided that he was going to tease me. It was after we had moved there to Boise. We lived on the corner house on 12th Street. I remember I was playing out in the back with one of my friends, and he kept just bugging us over, I don't know what we were doing, but he just was driving us crazy, and I kept telling him, you know, leave us alone, we're trying to play here, we're trying to do something, you know, and he just wouldn't do it. He just had made up his mind that he was going to get the attention, and I finally stood it about as long as I could, so I went over to him and told him that I didn't want him to do it anymore, or I was going to hit him, you know. And he said, "Oh, you wouldn't dare hit me, because if you did, I'd tell the folks and they'd get after you. So I just hauled off and whopped him a good one. And he went bawling, but before he could, of course, Dad wasn't home yet from work. And so the minute Dad got home from work, before anyone else could say anything, well, I went to him. And I said, Dad, I said, I hit Carlisle as hard as I could today. He would bug me and I was mad and I'm not sorry that I hit him. And he looked at me and he says, well, let's hear the rest of the story. And he got Carlisle in, and Carlisle had to admit that he'd been pretty ornery about bugging us. And so Dad says, well, you probably had it coming. And that was about all that was done about it. And I thought that was sort of a turning point for me, because up till then, seemed like everything that had happened, why, you'd get blamed for it because Carlisle was the baby and we shouldn't have picked on him. But that particular time, why, I sort of felt like that Dad upheld my decision on the thing, and it was something I kind of remember from that particular time. The church in Boise, as I had pointed out earlier, there was only one ward. We helped start build the second one, and there was an interesting thing about the church in those days.